Well, welcome everyone. I want to invite everyone, if you could, to please take your seats so that we can begin tonight's event. Thank you very much first for coming out tonight. Your presence means so much at this event, and thank you for braving the inclement weather. The fact that you came out through that weather for a debate tonight means that either you have a real strong passion for intellectual development or a really unhealthy appetite for pain and suffering. Not quite sure which, but we pray that tonight will be a very enjoyable and enriching and very lively conversation between two great, notable scholars. My name is Pastor Christopher Brooks. I have the privilege of being the pastor of a local congregation here in Detroit, Michigan, Evangel Ministries. And my job tonight is to be the moderator for this event, or some call me the referee. My job is to make sure that these gentlemen fight fair and abide by the rules. But on a very serious note, what we're here tonight to do is to make sure that we engage in a very important discussion about the origin of human worth. Already today, we've held two great discussions, an open forum earlier today, and then we spent the afternoon with the medical students, and I think about 300 or so have already been impacted by these discussions, and we pray that tonight will be just as engaging as the events have already been so far. You know, I believe that the reason why John Bayon and the sponsors for this event asked me to moderate is because there's a passion that I have to see men and women wrestle with the most important issues of our day. I think it's important that we do the rigorous hard work of evaluating truth claims to see which are tenable and which are logically and ethically incoherent. And so tonight, I don't want you just to listen, but I want you to evaluate. But remember, before we can critique anyone's view, we must first have a proper understanding. So please give both of these men an honest hearing before you respond. There will be time for you to respond. We're going to hear from both gentlemen in their opening comments and remarks. We'll have a short facilitated discussion, and then we'll take a break. And after that break, you'll be given the opportunity to ask your questions to Dr. Patrick and Dr. Singer. I do want to just acknowledge our sponsors, the Metanoia Graduate Christian Union, Equipped for Life, our radio program, and also the Christian Medical Association. Can you give them a big, big hand for putting on this event? They informed me that there are great resources. In the back, there is a resource table for you to be able to keep the conversation going. Hopefully, after this discussion is over, the conversation won't stop, because this is too important for us to stop tonight. So please stop at our table and pick up some resources. Some are free. Some do have costs associated with them. Also, at the break, there's waters that are out there for your enjoyment. One of the other things that I'm really excited about is that this discussion is being held in our city. I am passionate about Detroit, and I'm thankful that it's being held at Wayne State University, which has been the rich epicenter for intellectual development in our city for over 75 years. They've sponsored and underwritten this entire endeavor. So I would want to give Wayne State a big hand also for helping to sponsor this event. But let me, for just a few moments, set the context of the conversation we're going to have tonight, especially on the origin of human life, whether or not God does exist, and the implications that has on human worth. You know, it's been said that the litmus test for any society, morality, is seen in how they value and care for their children. If this is the case, the question that needs to be asked is, what value does human life have at all, if at all, any? Dostoevsky said in his books, The Brothers Karamazov, that if God does not exist, then everything else is permissible. That includes abortion, infanticide, and even euthanasia. However, if the first four words in the book of Genesis are true, and in the beginning God, then it will follow that there is a sacredness to life, and that human beings occupy a very special place in our world, and that we have intrinsic value because we were created by an all-powerful and all-loving God. These are the two positions that are going to be discussed this evening by our presenters. and they will do their best to try to present the distinctiveness of their views. Now, you know, we've all played that children's game before, and some of you know what it's like to brag to another child that my father is stronger, tougher, bigger, and faster than your father is. And unfortunately, a lot of people feel that this is the condition of most debates in our culture today around very critical issues, that they're nothing more than grown-up, highly educated, and intellectual children debating about relative matters and facts and leaving us with nothing but undefendable arguments and claims to superior views. And this is a saga that postmodernity has left us in. But I want to pose a question to you tonight. What if ethics and philosophy and theology could present us with truth claims that were more than just mere preference? What if tonight the presuppositions of both of our debaters, the ones that they hold so tightly and so firmly, could be rationally and evidentially measured against one another? This would mean that morality and ethics are more than just simply relative issues, but objective ethics and universal moralities can be given that govern or that should govern all of us. Tonight, what my hope is that each one of us will take this discussion extremely seriously, because whether or not you realize it or not, this conversation that's happening tonight is just a microcosm of a broader conversation that's happening all around our globe with very important and very influential people discussing it. And the outcome of this conversation will in many ways determine what type of society we become and the type of world that our children will grow up in. I hope that we'll all leave this auditorium wrestling with one very important question, and that is, how now shall I live? Regardless of whether or not you agree with Dr. Patrick or Dr. Singer, what you do have to ask yourself is, what is my view, and can I defend it, and am I living it? Tonight, we have two great scholars, as I mentioned before, and I want to introduce them both. First is Dr. John Patrick. He holds a degree from the University of London and St. George's Hospital Medical School in London. He has done extensive research into the treatment of childhood nutritional deficiencies and related diseases, holding appointments in Britain and in the West Indies and Canada. He lectures widely at universities throughout the world. He's visited the former Soviet Union and Africa, working with various international agencies and with the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. In 2002, he retired from his lengthy position as associate professor in clinical nutrition at the Department of Biochemistry and Pediatrics at the University of Ottawa. He speaks frequently to university groups on moral issues in medicine and culture and the integration of faith and science. He also is the president of Augustine College, a one-year post-high school institution. Can we give Dr. Patrick a big hand? Debating him tonight will be Dr. Peter Singer, who was educated at the University of Melbourne and the University of Oxford. He has taught at the University of Oxford, La Trobe University, and Monash University. And since 1999, he has been the Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics in the University Center for Human Values at Princeton University. From 2005 on, he has also held the part-time position of Laureate Professor at the University of Melbourne in the Center for Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics. Among Dr. Singer's numerous publications are his books, Animal Liberation, Practical Ethics, The Expanding Circle, Should the Baby Live, How Are We to Live, and The Life You Can Save. Dr. Singer was the founding president of the International Association of Bioethics and the founding co-editor of the journal Bioethics. Outside academic life, he is the co-founder and president of the Great Ape Project, an international effort to obtain basic rights for chimpanzees, gorillas, and orangutans. He is also president of Animal Rights International. Now, a little bit about our format tonight. Both gentlemen will have 15 minutes to make opening remarks. After that, we'll have a 45-minute discussion that I'll facilitate. We'll take a short break, and then we'll come back. And after that break, you'll be able to ask your questions as an audience to these distinguished gentlemen here tonight. Can we welcome for our first opening remarks Dr. Peter Singer? Can you give him a big, big hand as he comes?
Thank you very much for that welcome. I do appreciate it. I also notice the words you said at the beginning about Detroit and your passion for the city. And I must say, this is it's the occasion of being invited here that has brought me to Detroit for the first time. You probably know that Detroit doesn't always get the best press in the media around the country, but I have to say I have been very favorably impressed with what I've seen, with many fine buildings and public institutions, and obviously also importantly a culture of debate and discussion that we've been having all day today and that has been well attended throughout the day. So I really do appreciate that. Let me start with a comment on the remark that you quoted, Pastor Brooks, from Dostoevsky, the claim that without God, everything is permitted. That's something that I very profoundly disagree with, because I do think that there is objective truth in ethics, that it's not the case that everything is permitted, and I don't think that depends on belief in God. In fact, I don't even really see how belief in God would settle that question in a philosophically defensible way. I would not want to just take my views about right or wrong as if they were some kind of arbitrary command or dictate from God, because I wouldn't like the idea of a God who was a tyrant who just said, well, like a thunderbolt, I will make it good to, let's say, torture babies, and bad to help elderly people across the street. I mean, if God's saying what is good makes it so, that would be the case. But surely we don't want to believe in a God like that. But then that means that there have to be some independent standards. If we want to say God is good, God would not do something like commanding us to torture babies, that means that we already have this idea that there is some objective moral truth, that it's not a good thing, for example, to torture babies, and that that's not good because of what torturing babies is. You just think about that. You just think about causing extreme pain and suffering to a defenseless, innocent being, and that's got to be a bad thing to do, you know, at least in itself, it's a bad thing to do. You can imagine far-fetched situations in which that might be necessary for some much better consequence. But just taken in itself, that's got to be a bad thing to do. So I am not a relativist about ethics. I'm not someone who thinks that anything goes, but I don't take my morality from God. However, because I don't take my morality from God, I do have views about the topic that we're talking about, that is the value of human life, and in particular, what makes life of value as a developing human being emerges, that may be different from those that some of you, perhaps most of you, take. Because I think that we need to start with a viewpoint that asks, what is it that makes killing wrong? Now, that may be a question that some of you don't ask. You may say, well, it's in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill. But as I said, I don't take my morality from scriptures, and there's a lot of other things in scripture that I'm sure you don't agree with. I'm sure you don't agree, for example, that someone who works on the Sabbath should be killed. But it does actually say that in Leviticus, I think it is. So we make our decisions about which bits of the scriptures we're going to take as important and agree with, and which bits of them we're not going to really take any notice of at all. And so I think we have to ask these deep questions, that's as philosophers, what we should be doing and what any thinking person should be doing. So we have to say, well, what is it that makes killing wrong? Now, we might say, look, if a being could enjoy his or her life, then why not let that being go on living and let that being enjoy his or her life? And I think that that makes sense in a way, that we can understand that to a certain degree. But when we're talking about killing human beings, we go beyond that, obviously, because it's not only human beings who can enjoy their lives, it's dogs and cats and pigs and chimpanzees and many other animals. And yet we think that there is something worse about killing human beings than there is about killing those non-human animals. So what could that be? Well, I think it has to be something about the kind of lives that we can live, about the fact that we have higher intelligence, more rationality, more understanding of our lives, a greater self-awareness than any non-human animal can have. And I think that does give us a reason to think that normally the killing of a human being is much worse than the killing of a non-human animal. Because you're killing a self-aware being who has plans for the future, who wants to go on living, and you cut off those desires before that person can fulfill them. Whereas non-human animals don't have those sorts of desires, at least not to anything like the extent that we do. So that's my answer for why, in general, killing a human being is worse than killing a non-human animal. Why, when we read about some murder, some senseless murder, we think what a tragedy that is. If we read about somebody shooting a dog, we may think that that's bad, but we don't think it's a tragedy on the same scale. How then should that affect our views about early human life? Well, if we look at early human life, it's a gradual process of development from conception onwards. I agree with those people who are opposed to abortion that it is a gradual development from conception onwards. I don't think there's any one line at which you say, now we have a human being, whereas previously we didn't. In fact, I'm quite ready to agree with people who are opposed to abortion that we have a human being from conception, from the completion of conception. People sometimes talk about the moment of conception, but actually it's not a moment because it takes time for the sperm to penetrate the egg and then takes time for the gametes of the sperm and the gametes of the egg to unify. It takes about 22 hours before they do, so it's not really a moment. But I'm quite happy to say that sometime around that, say, around that time when the gametes, that is the genetic material of the egg and sperm, have fused together, you have a new, genetically unique human being. But remember what I said about what I think makes killing wrong and what makes killing worse than killing a non-human being. I said it was some level of self-awareness, consciousness. After all, it's not genetic uniqueness that is important. Every dog is also genetically unique in just the same way that every human being is genetically unique. In fact, neither of them are quite genetically unique because we can have identical twins or identical triplets in both cases, but otherwise they are. And I don't think the fact that the being is a human being is enough to make it wrong to kill it. That's where I disagree with people who are opposed to abortion. I agree that abortion is the taking of a human life. But it's not the taking of a human life with any awareness. At least abortion at the stage at which the vast majority of abortions are carried out, in the first trimester, is not the killing of a being with any level of awareness. I don't think there's any grounds for believing that in the first trimester the fetus is capable of feeling pain. If we're talking about a very late abortion, maybe at 20 weeks, very unusual to do abortion at that stage, but occasionally, for special reasons, it may be done, then I think there could be consciousness. But still not a level of consciousness that is even equal to that of a dog, let alone the self-consciousness that human beings normally have. So I don't think that the standard reason why it's wrong to kill normal human beings, why it's a tragedy if human beings are killed, applies to either the embryo or the fetus. Now, some of you might be saying, but surely the embryo and the fetus have the potential to become normal human beings with consciousness. And isn't that a reason why it's wrong to kill them? I agree, of course, that they do have that potential if allowed to develop. Although, I should say, there are some special cases that have been relevant to discussions we've been having about destroying embryos to obtain stem cells. Because if you're talking about a frozen embryo left over from in vitro fertilization, the chances that it will actually become a normal human being are very small, because we have hundreds of thousands of them in the United States, and very, very few people, very, very few women, I should say, who are prepared to accept one of those fertilized frozen embryos into their uterus and develop it as a child. So most of those hundreds of thousands of frozen embryos are, in fact, never going to become children. But, you know, put that complication aside. Let's say we're talking about a fetus in utero. It does have the potential to become a normal human being. But I do not think that that potential is enough reason to say that it is wrong to end its life. I said in one of the earlier talks today, one of the reasons why I don't think that is because I think our world, which has over 6 billion people and is heading for 9 to 10 billion by 2050, I don't think our world needs or wants more human beings. I don't think it's desirable to have a still larger population. I think that as our population increases, we put more pressure on our environment, we contribute more greenhouse gases, we will do more to change the climate of our planet, and we will actually imperil, we are already imperiling, I would say, the lives of hundreds of millions of existing human beings who, because of changing climate and changing rainfall patterns, are likely no longer to be able to sustain themselves by growing food. So I don't think we need more human beings. And for that reason, I don't think the mere potential of a fetus is a reason to say it is seriously wrong to bring to end that child's, that fetus's life so that you don't bring that fetus into existence. I think that can be a justifiable thing to do. Now, if you disagreed with me about the population issue, or if you like, if we imagine a world in which there are far fewer people, and you say, well, would I think abortion would be wrong if there were only 6 million people in the world rather than 6 billion? Well, I would say that would change my views in this way. I would then think it would be a good thing that there should be more people in the world. And insofar as an abortion prevents there being more people in the world, I would think that would be a reason, not necessarily a decisive or overwhelming reason, but a reason why you should not have an abortion. But equally, if what we're interested in is having more people in the world, we would want to encourage people to have more children. So it would equally be a reason against using contraception if you have the capacity to bring more children into the world. And so far as this reason is concerned, it wouldn't really differentiate much between abortion and the use of contraception. They would both be wrong because they would both prevent a future being who could live in this very underpopulated world, could enrich the world, could have a good life, could help others, and so on. And it wouldn't only be the use of contraception that would be wrong, it would also be abstaining from sexual intercourse if you're fertile and able to bring children into the world. Because that would also, of course, bring more children into the world. So I think if you want to use this as a reason to argue against abortion, this idea that it's good for there to be more people in the world, you are committed to fairly strange consequences in terms of an obligation to procreate, at least other things being equal, which most people don't believe in. Of course, if you do take morality from the Bible, you could take that injunction to go forth and multiply as something that is what you ought to do in those circumstances. And then, as I say, in an underpopulated world, consistently you could oppose abortion. Now, I've got 2 minutes left. So let me just say one more thing, a little thought to throw in, that's relevant specifically to the debate we've been having in this country about the destruction of embryos to early embryos to produce stem cells. It's another point that also relates to this issue about potential. We are developing interesting capacities as far as early human life is concerned. And if people say that it's wrong to destroy an embryo because it destroys a unique human individual, you could actually do this. You could let that embryo develop in the laboratory until it is 2 or 4 cells. In fact, these embryos that we're taking are already generally 2 or 4 cells. And you could then divide that embryo cells in half. And both of those halves now have the potential to become a complete human being. And you could use one of them and destroy it for taking stem cells. And you would have another one which was genetically identical with the one you destroyed. So when people say each embryo is unique and genetically unique, and that's why we ought not to destroy them, they often don't realize that this is not really in itself a good argument against doing what I just mentioned and destroying embryos. We can have the unique genetic embryo and we can have another one to destroy. So I think people who want to use that argument have to think of some different reason from genetic uniqueness, because genetic uniqueness has become, with our new technology, something that we can decide about. It's not just a matter of the freaks of identical twins. We can actually artificially produce identical twins or identical quadruplets if we wanted to. So we could preserve that uniqueness while still getting the stem cells. Just leave you with that thought, and we'll be back for further conversation. Thank you.
Notes as both of our presenters share their comments. Again, that will help in the facilitation of the Q&A after our break. Next up, can you please give a big hand to Dr. John Patrick as he comes at this time.
I'm also very pleased.
If you wish, that is. Those who wish to sleep at this time of day, I entirely sympathize. I hope not to be to fulfill W.H. Auden's description of a professor as someone who speaks in someone else's sleep. But the issue for tonight is, what duties, if any, do we owe to human beings in the early part of their development? And does it have any bearing whether that development from our point of view shall be perfect or otherwise? A secularist and a Christian are not going to agree about this. Throughout the history of the world, there have always been unwanted children. For most of that history, the way to deal with children that looked as though you couldn't handle them was simply, when they were born, because abortion was too dangerous, to deposit them at the city gates. In many places, there was a designated spot. And then anybody who wanted them could pick them up, and otherwise the dogs ate them. And that was so normal. There's an early letter from a soldier to his wife in the first century or so, in which the letter could have been written now. The wife is clearly pregnant, and he's hoping that she's well, etc., etc. And then the penultimate sentence, if the baby is a girl, expose it. If it's a boy, keep it. Love, John. That's how normal it was. Now, I maintain that one of the reasons for the successful growth of the church in the early centuries was childcare. Long before there was an organized church, and long before Christian writings were well organized, things had begun to change. They had only the oral story of Jesus, and a few letters, not much more. But they had had the experience of Jesus. And they started to think about what they had learned about God through his teaching. And they had a very simple approach. They said, God is good, therefore what God gives must be good in the long run. And they started keeping their own babies. They did not see how they would manage, but of course they did. Now, those of you who go to church know that a church without children will soon not be a church. Children are a measure of the health of the church, and churches that don't accept children deserve to die. Hopefully, in your church, if a single mum turns up, she shouldn't have to buy baby clothes thereafter. If it's a really good church, she'll get a lot more than baby clothes. She'll get fellowship, she'll get support. Particularly in this present day and age where too many boys have no father to roughhouse with, they might even get some help in that direction. I know one wonderful black pastor who, when he gets a single mother joining his church, he pairs her with two men who always go together to avoid sexual temptation, so that there is a male influence in the household. That's a smart move. So the early Christian church began to do this, and they found, my goodness, these children have brought us together, we're working together, we're cooperating, we're living better lives. They actually began to live longer as well. Then, of course, they made the obvious next logical step. They said, what about the children left at the city gates? And they started picking them up too. In fact, the first letter that I know of, written by a Roman politician to Rome about Christians, asks this question. He writes to Rome and says, these Christians are not exposing their own children, and moreover, they are rescuing the exposed children of others. What should I do? Rome never solved that problem. The result was that in three centuries, the church took over, or a bit more, steadily. You can imagine what it was like if you were a little boy or a little girl, and when you get to sort of the age where you can understand, your parents say, we have something to tell you. You need to know that you are our son or our daughter, and we love you dearly, but we didn't get you out of our desire for procreation, but because the love of Jesus took us to the city gates to pick you up, and you were the wonderful reward we got for doing that. If your mom or dad said that to you, would you need to be converted? It's done, isn't it? This is pure St. Francis. Preach the gospel, if necessary, use words. That was the early church. No other culture had done it like that before. And for a long while, it remained that way. Of course, during this same period, Hippocrates' insights into the importance of transcendence, belief in God and belief in judgment after death, to make the doctor more reliable, had also begun to work. And the pagan doctors who killed for profit disappeared from the Western world. The much maligned Dark Ages were not so dark. At the beginning of the decline of Rome, if you went into a garden, you would probably find a pornographic statue in the middle of it. By the 13th century, what gardens there were in monasteries, and you would find a Madonna or a cross. And the soul of Europe had been purged. Slavery in its explicit form had disappeared. There was still serfdom to a degree, but there were some rights for the serfs and some duties for the lord of the manor. No legislation. That's not a bad record. There's much more that could be said, but there isn't time. That was, of course, Christendom. There was no problem with social cohesion because there was only one belief system. And the church was guilty during these periods of using excessive power, for which it has repented and from which it has turned away. What did that do for us? There's something here that evangelicals in particular need to learn, and those of you who are not interested in these particular details can tune out, or you might learn something of interest. The problem with the evangelical church, in my view, at this point, is that you major too much on conversion, as though it is all that there is. It isn't. Let me just misquote St. Paul for a moment, and I can just about see you. You can raise your hand if you know what I've done to you, but I'm actually doing some serious historical damage to the text. And I'm going to paraphrase it to make it a bit worse. Paul says, the preaching of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to those who have been saved, it is the power of God. Hands up? Don't see any. Perhaps one. See, what he actually said was this: the preaching of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, But to those who are being saved, it is the power of God. Conversion is only the beginning of the story. So many evangelical Christians behave rather like somebody going to the hockey game and leaving after the national anthem and missing the game, not entering into the joy. That's very sad. And the church understood from the beginning that the next step was an act of reason. Step one is what I like to call tacit knowledge, taking it from Polanyi. Those of you who've had a conversion experience know that that experience cannot be fitted on anyone else. It's unique. It is also not an explanatory account in terms of what a rationalist would want. That doesn't make it unreasonable, because when you lose your reason, you lose your job, your mind, and everything else. But people who get saved tend to get better at their jobs, not worse. So God coming to you in conversion is better described as being supra-rational rather than irrational. But it is not adequately described by anything that current modern-day rationality would include. But that doesn't make it stupid. Of course, science recognizes this sorts of things happens. Einstein famously felt his equations, and then there was a great deal of work to do to find out whether they were true or not. That happens to many scientists, but unlike Einstein, our feelings are usually wrong. And in addition, we can't usually do the mathematics like he could. But there are many examples of that. Even in ordinary clinical medicine, just occasionally somebody will walk into your office and you'll know what's wrong with them before a word has been spoken. Now, you go through the procedure and then you find out you're right. Often you can work out afterwards how you did it, but not always. There are things in our world which don't fit into the current models. And what we tend to do is neglect them on the grounds that we're interested in statistical rules. And that's fair enough. That's the way we do science. But we ought to be honest about these other things. And there are things in our own world that we care about, that we can see this is true. A good example would be a Stradivarius violin. If the university's view of knowledge was right, and it's right as far as it goes, but not enough, you could take a Stradivarius violin to pieces and then make exact replicas of every part and have 2 Stradivarii. You could use computer-assisted design and be within nanometers of the 2. But you wouldn't have 2 Stradivarii. You might have destroyed 1. And nobody can tell you what it is in scientific terms that makes a Stradivarius. We may do that one day, but we can't do it at the moment. But someone like Pinker Zuckerman can hear a violin being played and say, that's a Stradivarius, and he's right. Now, there are modern violinists who make very good violins, and you might want to be a violin maker, and you go to one of these people and say, sir, I want to learn how to do it. Who tells you he's a good violin maker? Well, Pinker Zuckerman again. Now, you look at your work, and in most cases, you say, you haven't got what it takes. You might make a violin maker. Eventually, he'll trust a piece of valuable alpine pine to you, and you cut it out. And then you say, give it to me, and he'll feel it. He knows that if his violin is going to sing, all the bits have to fit together perfectly. And only if they do will the violin sing. And he can feel whether this is being achieved, whether this wood is not going to be in tension. Can he tell you how he does that? No. Even in a simple thing like an operation, you can see the same thing. In any city, I can ask the docs that I meet there, who's the best surgeon, who's the best internist? I won't get a random scattering of names. The same names will turn up. Then I ask why. They can't tell me. They begin to rationalize afterwards, but they knew first. Conversion is like that. And it's very hard for a rationalist to understand that what happened is so powerful that nothing will shift it. Doesn't make you irrational, you do your job better. But it's of a different order. You know that God came into your life. Now, that does not make you good, which is what the usual criticism of Christians, and they don't realize that Christianity made that criticism right from the beginning. And they knew that it wasn't so much a criticism as a statement of fact. All the epistles were written because the church was not living up to what it ought to. Any Christian here claim to be perfect? Of course not. We're still struggling with our own inner nature. Well, the problem with the modern world is it's in denial of the fact that we know what is good but cannot do it. The problem is not with knowledge, it's with the power to be and to do. Now, that can be changed slowly. And interestingly enough, this is something you do to your children whether or not they believe. Because We all agree on both sides of this argument that you can know what is good and what is evil. We won't agree entirely, but we'll have a lot of agreement. It's part of what it means to be human. It comes in the package, so to speak. But doing it can be helped by faith, is helped by faith. Because what you do when you believe is you begin to inhabit a story. Now, I'm a pediatrician. And here's an interesting question for you. What is the difference between the response of an under five and a seven-year-old to the question, would you like a story? And while I'm giving you my answer, I can just about see your faces well enough to learn whether you read to children. The seven-year-old will go to her bedroom and bring you the book she's in the middle of and will milk you for as many chapters as you will read. They'll even turn off the television for granddad or grandma or mom or dad to read a book. The under five, even in our house, and we have lots of grandchildren, will go to the cupboard, the shelf which is theirs, and bring a favorite book. I've read it many times before. I get bored easily, so I try and shorten it. There are some of you who read to children. As one of my grandsons said not long ago, has granddad forgotten how to read? The little brat has brought me a book he knows every word of. Why? And this is true of every culture that I have visited. The Jews know about this best. It's all described in Deuteronomy 6. But I think what he's doing is hardwired to believe that the repeated stories in his family's life are the way he finds out how to be one of them, how to be a man or a woman in this culture. Now, the number of stories that have supported big societies is quite small. And the nature of that story will determine, to a large degree, what kind of society you get and what you can do and what you can't. You need a certain sort of story to get to inductive reasoning and experimental science. If you believe in evil spirits, you cannot go there. You can't get there from there, so to speak. I cannot do nutrition education in a pagan village. It took me a while to learn because I'm dumb. And then I realized from their perspective, I was the idiot. Because a child ceases to eat because an evil spirit took his appetite away. So the obvious thing to do is to spend your money on the witch doctor to get him to drive the evil spirit away. I thought, well, that's easy to fix in my cold rationality. If I feed your child, he will get better. Ah, but you have a stronger spirit. Can't beat that argument. Different stories produce different outcomes. The problem with the evangelical church, it's not been telling its own story. It's allowed the world that followed the 15th and 16th century changes to dominate the way we express ourselves. We need to change that. What disappeared in particular is the idea of purpose, which dominated all ancient literature. But you use the word purpose in the average biology department of even this university, and the biologists will have apoplexy. So one student showed me not long ago a very good essay, but she wrote in the middle, "The heart looks to me to be marvelously designed." Great red line through it. If you use the word design in this course again, you will fail. Now, she didn't say it was designed. She said it looked as though it was designed to her. Isn't she allowed to have that opinion? Apparently not. Now, teleology is important. Of course, we can't actually live without it, especially in my own specialty of biochemistry. Of course, when we got the first sequence of DNA, we didn't know what it was. It was a physicist who understood. He said, that's got to be a code. Of course it was. Then we cracked the code and realized that it had long chains of amino acids in there. So the next thing we did was get that DNA to express that code so that we could get the protein with, 300 amino acids all tied up together. When you look at it under an electron microscope or in a model, it doesn't look pretty. It looks a bit like a ball of wool that a cat's played with. So what's the next question you have to ask? First you ask, what's the DNA for? Then when you've got the protein, when you've got the sequence, you say, what's the protein for? That's teleology. At this level, we can't do it any other way. Purpose is built into our world as a means of understanding, and we can't avoid it. We need to think about where it came from. What happened at that time is quantity displaced quality. Fact changed its meaning. Newton was the last of the medievals, really. He still believed that moral facts were more reliable than physical facts. Modern scientists think that physical facts are more reliable than moral facts. They're actually wrong, because what we think is a physical fact is often a misinterpretation of the data. But quantitation cannot be applied to all the things that matter to you most. You cannot live without love, without truth, without fidelity, without honor. None of them can be measured. And it's your conception of these things which will work out for you what your responsibilities are towards the unborn at all stages and towards the disabled in particular. I, for my sins, was arrogant enough to think that my understanding of perfection was enough to allow me to persuade women to have abortions a long while ago when it was still illegal, because their baby was not going to have a good enough quality of life as judged by me. I end up, irony being what it is, running a clinic for the severely disabled, and week after week being reminded of my foolishness. One little anecdote and I'm done, because I think my time is up. The one advantage of bright lights is that I can't see a controller. And I could go on neglecting him like Nelson putting his glass to the blind eye. But I'll never forget Melissa. A few years ago, interest rates went up into the double digits a long way. She was a little girl who could just manage to get around with a walker. She could not speak, and she needed help with feeding. She was about 5. And she came to my clinic regularly. Mum and Dad were having a hard time. Their business was going bankrupt. They were fighting quite frequently. But every time they fought, little Melissa would somehow get to her walker and insert herself between Mum and Dad. And she would not move until they kissed and made up. And Mum, with tears in her eyes, said, "If it hadn't been for Melissa, our family would have broken up." Now, Melissa is exactly the kind of child who I would have dismissed as having a life of no value whatsoever. I would have done the same with Beethoven too, but that's another question.
Our debaters several questions in which they'll have opportunity to respond.
Well, you're the expert on answering questions.
I'm going to ask that each one of you spend about 2 to 3 minutes responding to a question and then give the other an opportunity to present remarks and rebuttal. But you talked about, Dr. Patrick, the fact that we all operate from a narrative, and very clearly you have both distinctly different narratives. It's important, I think, for the audience to know the distinctions between your two views. So if you could, for just a moment, first Dr. Patrick, then Dr. Singer, discuss the distinctives between your view of ethics and your colleague's view of ethics, and how the world will look different if we follow your view of ethics versus your colleagues. And then, Dr. Singer, if you could do the same.
Yeah, well, from the point of view of the other side, I have a Pollyanna view of the world, in the sense that I believe it will be redeemed, that God is at work in it. That is based on my own experience and in looking at many other things that happen along the way. And of course, in terms of medicine, the place where that shows up in many places, and given the time constraint you put on me, the one that's most obvious is death and dying. When someone is dying, we do our best to make them comfortable, to make that exit as pain-free as possible. And we're very good at that now. Virtually no one dies in pain these days. And certainly if you're in a good center, it's an extremely small group of people who die in pain. And most of those die in existential pain, not in physical pain. We can control physical pain. We've never been better at it. But the question is, what do you say to children or to adults when death is approaching? And if they have faith, then it's much easier because they also have hope. Now, it may turn out that hope is not justified. Certainly, none of us can prove the existence of God nor the non-existence of God. Faith comes first. And Augustine understood that when he said that what you believe determines what you can understand. And the belief in God does change the way you die. And it doesn't matter where you are in the world. And I always say to medical students, if you want to see something that will push you in this direction, if you're open to that, never miss an opportunity to sit at the deathbed of anyone. Find out first what they believe, if you can, and you will see the difference.
Dr. Singer, if you could just comment on that for just a moment. What are the distinctives between your ethical views, and how will the world look different as we follow the different paths?
Well, the world would differ in a variety of ways. We were focusing, I think, in the session on early human life, so obviously, I guess, one difference is that I think it's justifiable to destroy embryos to obtain stem cells for research. The use of stem cells for research may lead to cures. We don't know for sure that it will, but it may lead to cures of a wide variety of diseases. So one difference might be that these diseases are cured if we follow my view, and not if we follow the view of those who think that it is wrong to destroy those stem cells. But there are many other differences as well. Obviously, the issue of abortion is relevant, and on my view, we will have a situation more like the one we have today, that is that women who get pregnant and don't want to get pregnant, don't want to be pregnant, will have the choice to end that pregnancy. Whereas, on at least some other views, that is not going to be the case. Now, we can discuss what the consequences of that might be. Obviously, many women who are pregnant and don't want to be are extremely distressed by that situation, but we could have a long debate about that consequences. At the other end of life, it does seem that Dr. Patrick and I clearly disagree about the permissibility of euthanasia. I am a supporter of patients' rights to decide when they have had enough. Obviously, I would want there to be conditions of that they be well informed, that they be settled in their decision, that it be a view that they've held for some time, not just that it be acted on immediately, that it's first uttered. But I would allow competent, autonomous adults to decide that their quality of life, the prospects of their future life, are so poor that they do not wish to live until a natural death. And I would allow physicians to assist them in bringing about a death at the time they want it, as in fact can happen already in the state of Oregon, and as happens in the state of Washington as well, and also in Europe, as happens in a number of countries in the Netherlands and Belgium and Luxembourg and in Switzerland as well. So these are not radically, you know, it's radically different societies. I don't think people who go to the Netherlands, where euthanasia has been practiced by physicians for more than 20 years, will find that this is somehow a harsh or intolerant society. On the contrary, I think Dr. Patrick agreed from a remark he made earlier that the Dutch are generally very kind, thoughtful people, and I regard caring for people and respecting their wishes at the end of their life as one sign of that. But certainly that would be a difference, that people would have more choice and the ability to act on those choices than they currently have in the United States, with the exceptions of Oregon and Washington.
I just want to add one little rider to that. I have no, and I think many people on my side of the equation, have no desire to stop others doing that, but to provide environments within which the two worldviews can be expressed. I would actually like to see development of two medical systems. I don't want abortion to be made illegal or euthanasia to be made illegal. I want them to be made unthinkable. And if we can't do that, then people are going to go on doing it. I think that's the better way to do it. Anybody who's seen a backstreet abortion death never wants to see another. No one should die that way. And if you hold the position Peter Singer holds, there's no reason why you should. If you hold my position, there's no reason why you would want to.
Dr. Singer, the next question will begin with you, and then Dr. Patrick, you can give rebuttal. As has been noted already, we're here to talk primarily about the early stages of human life, and in particular, I want to ask a few questions about the issue of abortion. which many will argue is the taking of an innocent life. So my question to you, Dr. Singer, is when, if ever, is it justifiable to take an innocent life?
Well, if your question is when is it justifiable, I mean, I can't give a short answer to that. Sorry, I've got some feedback there. I can't give a short answer to that because the expression an innocent human life covers everything from the zygote, the single-celled organism immediately after conception. I agree that that's an innocent human life, to one of us here. And I think it makes a huge difference at what stage of that life you're at. So I think that it makes a difference whether you're conscious, and it makes a further difference whether you're not only conscious, but also self-aware and capable of seeing yourself as existing over time. But then even apart from that, there are also questions about other possible circumstances where we could debate when it's justifiable to take an innocent human life. For example, the United States has been taking innocent human lives in Afghanistan. It's acknowledged that in its bombing raids aimed at Taliban, innocent human beings, civilians, have been killed. That's acknowledged on all sides. There's some debate about how many, but it's acknowledged that they have been killed and no doubt will be killed in future as the war continues. Is it justified to attempt to get rid of the Taliban by bombing areas where you know civilians are living and where you can foresee that some of those civilians will be killed? That's a case where actually I would say it's not justified, whereas it seems that most people in the United States and both the current president and President George W. Bush think it is justified. So we have to think about circumstances as well as thinking about the nature of the beings that we're discussing.
I think it's been very extensively covered here, but there's a huge literature on judicial execution and on the just war theory, and it's not agreed even amongst Christians altogether, and it's certainly not agreed amongst secularists. So, but there is a large literature which deals with that. In the context of medicine, we have two clear situations in which it might happen, where you choose the lesser of two evils, and where there is an unexpected effect of an attempt to do something good. So in each of those cases, an innocent life may be lost. From the Christian point of view, intention is the most important thing. Given our belief in God, he is capable of doing whatever he wishes. He doesn't look so much on our actions as in our intentions. If we've screwed it up, he can still sort it out, and sometimes that happens. The law-driven world has to be that way for us to understand it. But that doesn't mean there can't be interventions into it that cannot be described in that way. And you go to places in the developing world where you're beyond your limits of normal behavior and you see those things happen. So I don't have clear things to say beyond that point. So we have some examples, but we're not that so very different on that one, except that we would not kill for... In terms of the modern abortion, that's unthinkable for a Christian. And I want it to be unthinkable for others. The vast majority of abortions in America now are for essentially trivial reasons. They're contraception that failed. Of course, that was the argument that pushed Roe v. Wade through the courts. One judge said it was an exercise of raw judicial power, but what won the day was Americans have become used to an effective contraceptive, but it can never be perfectly effective, so there must be a backup. And the Protestant Church has to accept that in its acceptance of contraception, it set the table for this to happen. And it's still not repented of that.
Next question, I'll start with you, Dr. Patrick. Neither of you claim to be relativists. Dr. Singer, you made it a point to note that you're not a relativist in your opening comments. So the question is this, is if you believe in objective ethics, subjective morality, universals, if you will, on what basis or what grounding do you derive your view of objective ethics and morality?
Well, obviously, from a Judeo-Christian point of view, we believe that the law was given by God, but we also believe that our minds were given to us to work on those things, and Jesus sort of exemplifies that in the way in which he takes the law and reinterprets it to show us that we really only half understood it. The law, after all, in both Exodus and Deuteronomy is introduced by grace. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. So we've got two things operating in tandem here. A story which we are responsible for interpreting and understanding both with respect to the original recipients of that story and the current ones. Jesus has no problem with taking the Sabbath laws and saying that the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And in the Sermon on the Mount, he takes one law after another and deepens it in ways that we would never have thought of before, I think. So it is a progressive revelation, and it's still going on. When Paul wrote, there is neither man nor female, bond nor free, but we're all one in Christ Jesus, that ought to have been the end of sexism and of slavery. Well, we got rid of slavery in about 1800 years, and we're still working on the other one. We're not very quick learners. That's the way it is. But we make our progress in what should be done by thinking about what has happened to us already and using the means of grace in various ways and allowing them to work in our hearts and minds as we use spiritual disciplines. That's and the trouble with the current church is that it's not very much into spiritual discipline.
Well, I also think that it's an issue on which we have to use our thought and reflection and intelligence, and we could get it wrong, just as Dr. Patrick just pointed out. Christians got the issue of slavery wrong for 1800 years. So I think it's really a matter of reflecting on what we think of as intrinsically good and intrinsically bad, trying to separate that in some way from other things which might make things bad under certain circumstances, but not others. And one of the things that I think is pretty fundamental to this is the idea of putting yourself in the position of others. Now, you might say, well, aren't I then invoking a biblical idea of the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you? But this is, in fact, really a very widely shared idea of what is at the core of ethics, which is not distinctive to the Jewish or Christian traditions. You can find it even in traditions that don't have any belief in God, in Buddhist traditions and in Confucian tradition in China. You find this idea of putting yourself in the place of the other and thinking, you know, doing unto others basically as you would have them do unto you. So I think that that's a very useful method at getting towards what's objectively right or wrong. You ask yourself, how would I like this? Would I accept this if I had to live the life of the other person who is affected by it? Or if it's not one other person, and mostly it's not just one other person, if I had to live the lives of all of those affected by it, including my own, of course, but not giving greater weight to my own just because it's mine, but truly putting myself in the position of others. And if you can then say, well, taking everything into account, yes, I think I would do that, then I think you can say, that's something that I can claim is right. Now, you might still be wrong, because it might be that you haven't properly imagined what it's like to be in the position of others when this thing is done. And some of these things are very difficult to imagine, difficult even to have the knowledge, because they might project far into the future. We might do things that have consequences for people far in the future, and we might not know that what those things might be. As, for example, we didn't know about climate change a century or so ago, so we understand better, I think, the consequences of some of our actions now than we did then. So, you know, there are relevant facts that we have to learn. There's a task of empathy, of putting yourself in the position of others and understanding what it's like to be them that we also have to learn. But that's really what the task is. You know, it's trying to work that out and trying to see what things, what actions, what choices would make the world better for all of those affected by them.
Thank you. Dr. Singer, I'll go to you with our next question, and that is this. In your writings and in some of the comments that you made throughout the day, you argue that in certain cases, the value of the life of an animal, say a cow or a pig, may be equal or greater than the value of a life of a human being under certain circumstances. So with that being said, how do we go about trying to determine the value of a human being's life?
Right. Well, I think it's important to understand that normally, I think, as I said in my 15-minute talk, I think that normally it's much worse to kill the life of a human being, like one of us, than it is to kill the life of a non-human animal, because none of them have the capacities for self-awareness and for thinking of our lives as a whole and making plans for the future and having projects and achievements to come that we do. But tragically, there are humans born without those abilities and humans who will never have those abilities. And perhaps the most extreme example of this is the condition known as anencephaly, which is a term that comes from the Greek meaning no brain, but essentially it's a baby born with a functioning brain stem, but the rest of the brain is absent. The whole cortex is absent, and therefore there can be no capacity for consciousness, no awareness. This child will never learn to recognize his or her mother, will never smile at the sight of anyone else, will essentially be a vegetable. It might be an ugly term to use, but this really is an existence that has no more consciousness than that of a plant form of life. Now, most of these babies die very soon after birth because nobody treats them. No doctor encourages the kind of life support that might enable them to live for weeks or months. Although there have been very few cases, where some of them have lived actually even for years. But I would think that in those cases, that life does not have the characteristics that give human life normally great value. Doesn't even have the characteristics that give the lives of animals value, that is, their capacity to enjoy their lives. Obviously, a dog can recognize a human being and can be happy when someone that he or she knows comes home and is about to take it for a walk. So a dog is undoubtedly more responsive, more aware of the environment, more able to enjoy life than an anencephalic infant. So that, at least at that extreme, is a case where I would say it's would be worse to, for no good reason, end the life of the dog than it would be to end the life of the anencephalic child. I should just add, the views of the parents are, of course, relevant. And if the parents, for some reason, do want that child to live, we should certainly listen to them. That is important. But I'm assuming a case where there are no parents or the parents don't wish for their child to live, as is, in fact, usually the case with anencephalic infants.
Dr. Patrick, if you could, again, respond. And the question, again, is how do we determine the value or potential of a human's life?
You're asking one of the most difficult existential questions that comes a doctor's way. It's not an easy question to answer at all. These children both make and break families. Anencephaly, for the reasons that Professor Singer has pointed out, is not a huge problem. You can care for those children in terms of keeping them comfortable and they die quite soon. There are many other syndromes which I've seen that and dealt with that are not like that and that are extremely difficult to handle and take a long while. They don't die quickly. And I can understand that someone who has no real faith in a providence overall would not be able to handle those. And I think there are some people who do have that faith who wouldn't be able to handle them. But there are people who can, and I think we need institutions to do that. Because I fear very greatly moving to a society where we start measuring what makes a person in terms of some function, because we all lose our functions in due course as we see it. But there are passive functions as well, and they have huge impacts on society, and almost invariably overall for good, but not invariably. I mean, what used to be done with mentally disabled people, say, a couple of centuries ago was horrendous. And you go in a developing world, it still is. I mean, there are horrendous things going on. I simply couldn't kill any of these children. I would make them comfortable. Every doctor has been through situations where you wish that this would be over, but that's a long way from being willing to finish it. This is one of the great problems that faces the human race. And I get very upset with people who take very cut and dried views to this without realizing how incredibly nuanced and complex it is. And you shouldn't use these very hard cases to set the general principles for how society lives. And we're tending to do that. I don't think that's a good way to go about it.
If I can go to the next question, and I'll start with you, Dr. Patrick. You've spent a significant portion of your life in Africa, helping and serving there. And Dr. Singer earlier commented on the strain that's upon our world's environment, resources, the argument of overpopulation. How do we justify helping to rescue the lives of children, for example, poor children in developing countries, if we are facing this tension of an overpopulated world with strained resources? How do we justify helping to rescue those children?
Well, the first level of justice, those children have done no evil. We shouldn't do evil to them once they're here. The question is, what should we do in terms of the future? Now, of course, there's a vast overstatement of this problem. The feeding capacity of the Earth has been estimated at a minimum, has certainly reached 12 billion. Already, throughout the world, there's a very steep decline in reproductive rates, and AIDS is pushing that along at a rate of knots. So the whole of the southern African cone is now facing population contraction at a very rapid rate. The whole of the Western world is failing to reproduce itself now, except the US, and it's not doing it from within its borders. It's only because it has a leaky southern border. The best contraceptive the world has ever found, the best anti-fertility thing, is actually materialism. The French had population stability long before we had a contraceptive. So the moment you can say we could have another baby or we could have a holiday in the Caribbean, you've got population control. In the Western world, without any question, the problem over the next few years is population decline, because, of course, the economy is directly related to the size of the population. The people in this auditorium tonight, it's doubtful whether there'll be enough people to look after them when they get old. One doesn't know what's going to happen in that context. There are vast stretches of the world that are totally uninhabited. In fact, at the beginning of, just as the Rwanda war was beginning, my wife and I were doing an 8-day walk through the Itumbi Mountains in Central Africa, because from the plane I had seen communities up there that I didn't know existed. But for 2 days, we had to sleep in the bush because there was no one. This was fertile land. To put it in perspective, if you do the calculation, you could put the whole of the world's population with a house and garden in Ontario, in Canada. Now, I know a lot of Ontario is not habitable, but it does give you a sense of where we're at the moment. There's a long way to go, and materialism will certainly cause us to go in the other direction. The other thing that's going to happen, of course, with our increased movement around the world, is that we're going to have a lot more diseases that go from A to B very quickly. And I'm not frightened of terrorists flying into big buildings and killing a few thousand people. I'm glad I'm not a terrorist, because I could kill a few million.
Dr. Singer?
I'm not as optimistic as Dr. Patrick is about the global population issue. It is certainly true that population is not rising in Western countries, and in some of them is falling. But it is still rising very fast in many developing countries, including many African countries. Many of these countries are already with quite large populations, like Nigeria, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, so-called, and Ethiopia are experiencing rapid population growth, on track to double their population before 2050. Even if there is still fertile land there, there is obviously people are having difficulties already in sustaining themselves. Plus, I believe that climate change is going to affect rainfall patterns in many places. It has already affected rainfall patterns in the place where I come from, southeastern Australia. Mm. And we've had very severe droughts for 12 years or so. Looks like this year has been a bit better, but it does seem, I mean, some of those years when we used to be a rice exporter, some of those years we couldn't grow any rice, and world rice prices went up. In part because of that in those years. So I do think that we have a problem with population. But your question was, how do we justify rescuing children in those circumstances? We justify rescuing children, firstly, because when children want to live and when their parents want them to live, it's a terrible thing to allow them to die when we could help them. And we can help them. And we should be doing a lot more to help them, in fact. We do extraordinarily little, as I told some of the earlier groups today. The United States gives around 30 cents, maybe generous 35 cents, in every $100 that we earn as a nation. We spend money on all kinds of luxuries when we don't really need, and we give just cents to those who are in extreme need. I think that's wrong, and I've advocated that we should be doing much more. I've written a book about this called The Life You Can Save. I've set up a website with the same name, thelifeyoucansave.com. If you want further information, please go and have a look. Now, does this mean that, how does this fit with the fact that I said I do think the world has a population problem? Well, letting small children die has never been shown to be a way to stop population growth. In fact, those countries that I mentioned that are growing most rapidly do have high infant mortality rates because when their children die, parents just have more children. They want there to be, if they're poor, they want there to be children who will look after them when they're old because there's no social security in these countries. No one else is going to look after them. So they want to have surviving children, and since they know that their children often die in infancy or early childhood, they have more. If we want these countries to stabilize their populations, we have to help them, firstly by assuring them that their children are likely to survive, and secondly by providing education, especially by providing education for the girls. Because all the evidence shows that one of the most effective ways to reduce a woman's fertility is to give her an education. The more years of education a girl gets in a developing country, the fewer children she's likely to have. So I think we need more aid, not less, if we're going to solve what I see as the world's population problem.
I'll ask one last question of both of you before we take a brief 10-minute break. And at the risk of getting a little bit off topic, this is an end-of-life question. And the question I have for you is, how should we care for those at the end of life who, for example, like the popular issue or debate that went on in our country a few years ago, Terri Schiavo, in a vegetative state, or those who suffer from Alzheimer's. What responsibility to care for these individuals do we have as a society, and what's the basis for that?
Is this me?
Yes, it starts with you.
Thank you,
Dr. Singer.
Okay. I think the major thing that we should be doing in these cases is to get more people to express their wishes while they're still competent about how they would like to be treated if they are no longer competent. That was really the problem with the Terri Schiavo case. There would have been no Terri Schiavo case if she had signed a document saying, I don't wish to continue to be kept alive if I am ever irreversibly lose consciousness. Assuming that we would have got agreement on that she had irreversibly lost consciousness, and I do think, at least in some cases, we can get agreement on that, not maybe in every case, maybe it was disputed in the Schiavo case. But her husband Michael said that that was her wish. Her parents denied it. So there was a factual dispute here about what did she really want. If people would just fill out documents, either way, you know, if they would say, look, I want to be kept alive, or I don't want to be kept alive, they would get them witnessed, they would lodge them with a doctor or somebody, appoint somebody to look after that, we would resolve a lot of these cases. But I think it ought to extend not merely to withdrawing life support, as happened in the Terry Schiavo case, the pulling out the feeding tube, but I know that if I am ever so severely demented that, for example, I can no longer recognize my own children or my wife, I do not want to go on living. I do not want to be kept alive in that state. I don't want the last memories that my children and my wife, if she's still alive, has of me as somebody who is lying in a bed completely unaware of anything that is going on around them, gradually shriveling up, as people do with dementia, and I've seen that happen, and I think it's a terrible way to go. But under present law, if you get Alzheimer's and you have nothing else wrong with you, there is no legal way to give me my wish. So I think not only should we have much more education so that people fill out these declarations, advanced declarations, or give powers of attorney to people to make those decisions for them, but I think it should be possible to act on those wishes so that once somebody has irreversibly lost consciousness, someone can give me a lethal injection and I'm not lying there in a bed for months or years while I slowly decline further.
Dr. Patrick?
I think this is an extremely important question. One of the things that I hope that the people here who come from churches, for instance, will do is two things straight away, and that is to see that your church hires a patient advocate, and secondly, that your church offers powers of attorney. Not that we would want to be killed, but there is no requirement to take burdensome treatment. And a lot of burdensome treatment is inflicted on patients because of the fear of lawyers, which doctors rightly have. I gather that in Texas, your probability of being sued is 1 in 5 in any given year. That's frightening. So we need to do something about that. And the church certainly can do that, because if you hired a nurse, for instance, so that any elderly person going to interact with the healthcare system had that nurse go with them, not to sit outside, but to go in for the interview, that would make the doctor's life a lot easier, because we could ask the patient the questions we need to and then dump on the nurse, who understands the vocabulary, what has to be discussed and thought about. Elderly people are not stupid, but they do process more slowly. I'm noticing that as I approach these rather frightening years. Some would say I'm already there, but that, you know, I'm still relatively content. But I watched as my wife went through breast cancer this year, how much more difficult it would have been if I and her son-in-law had not been there to explain and to act as an advocate. And most people don't have that privilege. So churches should think about providing that. And it will mean that many more people die at home, which is the right place to die, with their family around them, witnessing to the hope that they have. An intensive care unit can be more intensive than careful quite frequently, and that's not a good place to be. Those of you who like a good story that deals with this, Wendell Berry has written a lovely story. There's a book called Fidelity, and the chapter story in that is about an intensive care unit. And it's a hilariously funny story, but it's also deeply, it's wise, and I think there's a lot we could learn from that. So that's patient advocates. Power of attorney is simply that it is important for the doctor to know what your belief, what you desire, and your beliefs should determine that. And what you want, particularly at the end of your life, you don't want to put all that burden on your family, because none of us have actually treated our nearest and dearest quite as well as we should wish. And so we tend to deal with that sense of failure by inflicting treatments on them that they don't need. So somebody who shares their belief, a good doctor, a good lawyer, and someone like my wife who can face anyone down, that would be perfect. And in fact, they would be very welcome in the local intensive care unit very quickly, because they come with legitimate power of attorney and a clear understanding of what the patient wants, which is what we're often looking for. Now, in terms of euthanasia, as I said before, as with abortion, I see that it's a perfectly rational decision for someone who believes there is no God and life is ultimately without meaning. Camus said suicide is the only real problem, the only real question, and from a secular point of view, he's right. And we are no longer a society with a moral consensus, and since I wish my view to be honored, I would actually honor the views of others. My concern is that we keep these things in separate compartments, because Hippocrates' great move away from killing under any circumstances made a huge positive benefit for us. So I really do want to keep these things separate. I think we need two separate healthcare systems. One which I would call practicing Hippocratic medicine, which Orthodox Jews, Christians, Muslims, even high-caste Hindus would want, and secular medicine. And they're going to have different outcomes, and they will serve different people. We will end up looking after most of the disabled, because the other thing that will certainly come along once you make euthanasia legal, palliative care will diminish, as it has in Holland. There's a fraction of the amount of palliative care available in Holland that there is, say, in Britain. And the British doctors went and did a survey of the Amsterdam hospitals and found 50% of the patients receiving suboptimal pain care. And it is true that if you're a patient in Amsterdam, and you go into a hospital, someone will come and sit next, come up to your bed and offer to sit there with you to make sure that you're not killed. Peter Singer was making the point that there's not much of that going on. That's not what I hear from my colleagues in the profession. The public relations put out by the college says the opposite, but the anecdotal data doesn't confirm it. So we are heading to a very different form of medicine. People are talking about clients rather than patients, contract rather than covenant. These are entirely different worlds. Those of you who have been here for all three lectures, you have seen two different types of world. Not many of us would be capable of being as honest and as upright and as moral as Peter Singer, because most of us accept that the one Christian doctrine that needs no proof is the fall. We all acknowledge, I know what is good, but I find it extremely hard to do it. I know what is evil, but I often end up doing it. I need help. So I have colleagues who are secularists who are not as nice as Peter Singer. And I'm not as optimistic about what will happen in the long run. Certainly, we have seen, say, cheating rates to get into medical school go up steadily over the years. And have students say to me, but I have a right to go to medical school. So you made the exam too hard, I had to cheat. What about the people who didn't cheat? You've kept them out. Tough. In a Darwinian world, there is a problem. An Australian philosopher, David Stove, has written very well about this. There is a model of altruism that can lead to group altruism. The guy who developed it was accorded accolades in his obituary in both Science and Nature. The only problem with his model, Willie Hamilton's model, is that it doesn't explain. In order for it to work, you have to do a sort of swift calculus of how many shared genes you have with the person who needs your altruism before you do it. For it to work, if you're crossing a bridge and somebody jumps in to commit suicide, if it's your identical twin, you jump immediately. If it's a cousin, there's a momentary hesitation. By the time you get to Outer Mongolia, it's 20 minutes. That will produce group altruism, but it doesn't describe human beings. We need explanations that actually explain. We jump in front of a bus to rescue a child, no matter what's going on. We don't think about whether we're at risk. We see what needs to be done, and we do it, fortunately. And that's worldwide to a large extent. Now, some things, you look at the data that we both looked at last week on charity. It's very interesting that the likelihood that help will be given to a stranger is not universal. It's down in the 20% levels in many countries. So, on our nature, we are not quite as good as we would like to hope. For instance, I can just about see James in the front row there to illustrate what I'm talking about. Let's imagine for a moment that James has cancer, and that last week in my lab I invented a cure for his cancer. But I haven't said anything about it yet. Should I give that cure to James? Now, the normal human answer is yes. But what if I'm a well-thought-out Darwinian, and James is a wealthy man, and I inherit his estate when he dies? What am I to do now? He's clearly genetic competition. If it really is a competition of the genes, which I don't think explains human development at all, but if it were, then I should keep it. What you believe does make a difference to how you behave rationally. And over time, all of us are logical, but very slowly these days, because we're not as logical as, say, Peter Singer is.
Can I make one quick question about euthanasia in the Netherlands? Because I think there's one fact that really does counter what Dr. Patrick said. The Netherlands was the first nation to openly practice euthanasia. The second nation to do so about 10 years after, maybe 15 years after, I'm not quite sure, was Belgium.
Yeah.
Now, Belgium is both the neighbour of the Netherlands, and it is the only country in the world, the only other country, a majority of whose population speak Dutch, or Flemish, but Flemish is really equivalent to Dutch. That means the Belgian people, more than any people in the world, can know what is going on in the Netherlands. They can watch the television that the Dutch people watch. They can read the newspapers and magazines that the Dutch people watch. If they want to, they can read the original versions of reports. They were the second nation in the world to legalize voluntary euthanasia. After watching what had happened across the border, they voted for a very similar law. If, in fact, there was a serious risk that people who didn't want to be put to death were getting euthanasia in the Netherlands, I can't believe that the Belgians would have been so callous or so stupid that they would have said, we should have the same laws here that we have across the border.
Can we give both of our debaters, presenters, a big hand? Now, I don't want you to leave because tonight, a big part of tonight was designed around your interactions. Hopefully you have some challenging questions, much more challenging than the ones that I've already presented to both of these gentlemen. So we're going to take a 10-minute break. Now, when we come back, we'll be joined by two other guests, Mr. Jim Boll, who will be joining us. He is the medical director at Angela Hospice, and also Dr. Bruce Russell, who has been, as many of you may know, a part of the philosophy department here at Wayne State for over 30 years and chaired it for 10 years. They'll both be joining us to take your questions. So let's take a quick 10-minute break. It's about 7:45, so at 7:55 we'll come back, line up, and begin to take your questions.